Good. So I am recording this. This is Rick Hansen. It's June 30th, 2010. As most of you know, I record these talks and then post them both on the wisebrain.org website as well as my own personal website. So if you ever want to go back and listen to a talk or share it with anyone, it's freely offered and you can do that. As I alluded to momentarily ago, I was on retreat for most of June, one way or another. I was set up to be at Spirit Rock for 25 nights, but midway through my retreat, very gracefully and not unexpectedly, my wife's mother passed away. And so I got the word, it was quite intense in a retreat environment, and we all decided that it made sense for me to continue the middle portion of the retreat I was doing, but still leave after 17 nights total. So I've kind of kept on retreat in my mind. We flew down to Los Angeles for the memorial service, which I got to officiate at, which was quite something, to really reflect on a person who had a very long and beautiful life with about as peaceful and happy and graceful an ending as you can possibly imagine, while being very grounded still in a retreat whose theme for me personally was a lot about a very deep sense of the endlessness of endings, you know, as well as the endlessness of beginnings, moment by moment by moment, in a way that has a great sense of groundlessness to it. So in that context, I have such a real example of the ending of a life and the beginning of other lives with her grandchildren there. It was really quite powerful for me. So I've been kind of continuing in that mode, and I hope to share tonight with you the first of three themes that were very strong for me on retreat, embodiment, the other two being relinquishment and love. Relinquishment, by the way, sounds like kind of a fancy word. I should explain it. It's, at one level, it's kind of a technical Buddhist word that has to do with the natural response with the growing insight into the impermanence of everything and the futility, really, of trying to do the usual number that the ego wants to do of grasping after sense pleasures and struggling with anything that's unpleasant and, you know, perpetuating me, myself, and I. There's a growing sense of relinquishment as a kind of relief, really, based on all that. And so I'm going to talk about that next week. And then love, so fundamental, woven through both those themes, but especially explored 3 weeks, or rather 2 weeks from tonight. So that's my hope. Are you up for it? Okay, great. I hope to channel some of that retreat mojo. One of the things they did, the middle part of it was led by some monastics. And one of the things they did is they would come along and flicker, you know, blessing water on people. So, you know, I can't really do that with water, but I'm going to sprinkle some pixie, you know, love dust on you, some bliss dust on you, some awakening dust on you, you know, and spread it around, too. And you can sprinkle it on yourselves and those around you, your own awakening dust, because we all have awakening dust here. Okay, so a word about retreat. How many of you have ever gone on a meditation retreat of at least one night? Okay, that's wonderful. That's the great majority of the people in the room. If you haven't ever done it, I really recommend it. Find some setting that's comfortable for you. I like Spirit Rock. It's simple. It's clean. The hot water comes on. You know, the food is really good. Nobody hassles you. It's really okay to slip off to your room for a nap. It's okay to take Advil. I don't care what they tell you. It's really okay. So give me all the dirty secrets. It's okay to bring coffee. I was not alone. You know, that said, it's the real deal. It's really the real, real deal. You could bring your Game Boy or something, you know, and sneak off to, you know, work your emails, but what's the point? Anyway, there's nothing, as I said to my kids after my first retreat, there's nothing as powerful as nothing. You know, nothing is very powerful, and all kinds of things get stirred up. It's not always a bed of roses. On the other hand, I think a lot of other people would say the same thing. You know, when you go on vacation, you have that really nice moment of where you feel really relaxed and contented, and it's okay, right? You're there by the pool, got the Mai Tai, the beach novel. It's all, the kids are quiet, or they're not there, or something. It's just, or you wake up in the morning, clean, you know, oh, man. Well, How long does that usually last on vacation before there's somehow the next thing? 45 minutes, an hour, 5 minutes? You know, on retreat, often it's hour after hour after hour of this deep sense of relaxation and contentment. Lots of other stuff's going on, but it is interesting to reflect on that. Okay, so as context here, we've been exploring the four applications of mindfulness, or the four foundations of mindfulness, which the Buddha said 2,500 years ago, kind of the uber coach, if you think about it, in personal transformation. As awesome as Tony Robbins is, you know, he's had nothing on the Buddha. Anyway, so, you know, he said, really, there is this direct path to awakening. It's bringing mindfulness to these four domains: the body, the feeling tone, moment to moment of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Third, your overall state of mind. Is it tilted in a positive direction or a negative direction? And then fourth, a bunch of major themes, including the Four Noble Truths. Right? Those are the four applications or domains of mindfulness. He began with the body, and we've been exploring the body. We've been using a wonderful book as our baseline, which I highly recommend if you don't have it, called Satipatthana by Analeo. It's a really excellent book on the four applications of mindfulness. And today I'd like to wrap up the topic of mindfulness of the body with this consideration of embodiment. The context, of course, is one that we've heard before, probably many times. It's that everything changes, everything's connected to everything else, so that nothing arises entirely on its own. Nothing has absolute self-existence, including I. And the reality of what the Buddha called dukkha. Stress, strain, pressure, dissatisfaction, not quite right. The word dukkha in Buddhism has a very, very interesting origin. It is built from two compounds. The root du, which means kind of like duh, it means like yucky, bad, wrong. Not morally wrong, but just not working. Nuh, eh. That's kind of a pretty good translation for do. And then ka is the point that an axle meets the hub of a wheel. Just think about that. It's an axle meeting the hub of a wheel in a duh, not quite right way. In other words, it's a kind of wobbly grinding. Right? There's three kinds, really, of wobbly grinding in life. One, there's the innate pain of existence, you know, both physical pain and emotional pain, unavoidable discomfort. Second, there's the dukkha, the wobbly grinding of change itself, particularly around loss and decline. Nothing so clear about that, you know, when officiating or presiding at a funeral service. And then the third form of dukkha is what's called compounding, where we react to the dukkha that's present and we have dukkha, you know, we add to it, or we react to situations that actually don't have any dukkha at all. They're just situations, you know, or even we react to good things, like someone pays us a compliment and we feel bad about ourselves as a result, right? Like, well, if you only knew, or, well, you're putting pressure on me to rise to that standard from now on, you know? Okay, so those are the three characteristics of existence that the Buddha named: impermanence, interdependence, or emptiness, and then third, dukkha, suffering, stress, distress, discomfort. If you think about it, the Buddha was very, very interested in happiness and what led to reliable happiness. And he said, you know, in a world in which everything is continually changing and everything is connected to everything else, and there's this innate dukkha in just living, what can we really count on for true happiness? It's a real question, isn't it? What can we truly, truly count on? And it's interesting that, in effect, the only reliable thing is the nature of things. The only thing we can really count on is that things are continually changing, continually interdependent, and we suffer if we struggle with that fact. Right? That's what we can count on. That's where we can take our refuge. That's the larger context here. And seeing the endlessness of endings, you know, what I call eddies in the stream, the endlessness of formations arising in the mind or out here in physical reality, swirling together for a time and then passing away, and coming to peace with that, and realizing, based on direct experiencing and observation, the futility of grabbing after anything there, and the recognition that what comes and swirls and passes away is sometimes is pretty good, sometimes it's pretty bad, but it just keeps streaming. And less and less to take one's home in these eddies, these clouds, these swirls flittering by, and more to take one's seat in a felt sense of recognition of the true nature of things. That's a path with heart. You know, that's the path we're engaged in. And as we get more and more comfortable with the ground constantly falling away beneath our feet, and more allowing around that, we find more and more a peace and a happiness that's unconditional. In other words, it's not grounded in conditions. It's grounded in the reliable nature of everything. That's the larger context here. I wanted to share with you a picture of a teacher who happens to be the one at the Spirit Rock Gratitude Hut that I'm most drawn to. And this is Ajahn Mun, who was the teacher of Ajahn Chah. Ajahn is an honorific, like a title, of a monastic who has 10 years of robes, of 10 years of monastic life, Ajahn. Anyway, Ajahn Chah was the teacher for Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, as well as other people. And so that's kind of the main lineage here. If Ajahn Chah is the godfather of Vipassana in America and Europe, Ajahn Mun is the great godfather. And so I want to pass around his picture and just take a moment to look into his eyes and see what you see there. You know, and kind of hang out with that for a moment and then pass it on to the next person while I keep talking. Okay? You want to have a first peek? Okay, great. So Ajahn Mun had a wonderful quote. He said, "In your investigations of the world, never let the mind desert the body. Examine its nature, see the elements that comprise it, see the impermanence, the suffering, the selflessness of the body while sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. When its true nature is seen fully and lucidly by the heart, the wonders of the world will become clear. In this way, the purity of mind can shine forth, timeless and delivered." He was considered, by the way, an arahant, which is the fourth stage of enlightenment in Buddhism. Someone, and for me at least, you just look in those eyes. I mean, look past the, I mean, he didn't eat a lot of food. You know, he's a forest monk. And so he's pretty skinny. But you just look in his eyes. You know, that combination for me, at least, of intensity, emptiness, kindness, and fierce surrender to the fundamental truth of everything. You know, to me at least, that's what you see there. You don't see any clinging in those eyes. So as he says, "In your investigations of the world, never let the mind desert the body." Why? Why is it important to embody our practice? I got to tell you, that was one of the, you know, there were half a dozen major league takeaways for me from this time of retreat, and that was one of them for sure. Because I think I know for sure of myself, and I think I'm not alone here, my insight, my understanding, but more fundamentally even, my intuitive insight into the way it all is, had outstripped the underlying embodiment of that and enactment of that in everyday life. And I'm not just talking here intellectual understanding. I'm talking about genuine insight. I think there's a lot of genuine insight in this realm, genuine moments of recognition and then remembrance of that recognition that's stable for us. We know what's true. But to what extent do we actually live what's true in the way we reach for a cup of coffee, right? Or what we do when we're driving through traffic, or how we sit when we're typing emails, or how we stand when we're in line and it's not going fast enough. You know? What do we do then? How do we open that letter? That's what I mean. And so, as Ajahn Mun says, you know, we all want change,
We all want to become transformed. That's why we walk that path. There's a lot of truth that's top down, but there's also a lot of truth that's bottom up. It's not either or. I've been in rooms where it's kind of like the cultural pendulum swung too far the other way. There are people who are really talking about this kind of flighty, highly emotional, highly intuitive, you know, butterfly sort of way of relating to things. And that's a good way, but it's not the only way. You know, there's a place for rigor. There's a place for clarity. There's a place for understanding. The Buddha had a lot of Dharma. You know, it boiled down to a handful of things. But there's a place for insight. Okay. But what's more developed? For me, you know, head was more developed, has been more developed than body and heart. And I think that's actually true for most people. I think it's really true for our culture as a whole. So if we really want to change, you know, if we really want that transformation that our heart longs for, it's really important to think about embodying it from the bottom up. So what are some of the benefits of being in the body, of practicing in the body, practicing as the body? Okay? For one, if you're aware of the body, in other words, if you're establishing mindfulness, as the Buddha put it, in the body, or as Ajahn Mun said it, not letting the mind desert the body, it brings you right into present time. If we're thinking about the past or thinking about the future, we're not in the body. You know what I mean? We're in the simulator, kind of twirling around with that sort of fantasy or reflection. More planning or consideration or problem solving. We're not here and now. Also, if the mind is not grounded in the body, what's it going to do? It's just going to flitter away, right? It's going to look for something else to rest itself upon, to fixate on, including some desire of one kind or another, some form of clinging and some form of suffering. So if we continually return the mind to the body, particularly something simple and ongoing and mildly pleasant, like the sensations of breathing for most people, and if the breath isn't that for you, find something else that is mildly pleasant and ongoing. If we do that, then we ground the body, kind of like a lightning rod grounds the electrical charges in a storm. Being in the body is also a kind of concentration practice, because if we steady the mind in the body, we are steadying the mind altogether. Right? Okay. Also, if you think about it, if what's the enactment of non-clinging? You know, as Joseph Goldstein says, there are all kinds of Buddhist schools, there are all kinds of spiritual traditions. Not one of them says, cling more! Right? Okay? What is not clinging? If it's not conceptual, what is it actually? You know, what is it actually really? It's a kind of bodily surrender. There's a kind of bodily surrendering, a bodily opening out. We're not trying to hold on to anything. We're giving up to, we're yielding to. We're not resisting the changing moment. We're not resisting the causes streaming through. Too much is going by too fast. If we're really in the present and we're really non-clinging, we're not clinging in the body. We're just letting it flow. What that also does is it takes us into our experience. One of the things that also became clear to me is the degree to which that I, a major kind of a warrior of psychological practices for 35 years, was still subtly caught up in trying to manage and change and resist my moment-to-moment experience. Rather than simply letting it be what it is in a very, very fundamental way. It reminds me of what a friend of mine said once when I asked him what he did when he meditated. He said, I try to fabricate as little as possible. You know, in other words, he was trying to add, to change, to edit, to modify, to tweak as little as possible. Now, let's be clear. It's really important to have both mindfulness and wise effort. Mindfulness alone, awareness alone, allowing alone, is not a complete practice. All right? I think sometimes people in the West have made mindfulness alone out to be the be-all and end-all of Buddhist practice or psychological practice, therapy these days. That, I think, is completely misguided. That's definitely not what the Buddha taught. There is a place for wise effort. But if we don't ground wise effort in a radical openness and allowing to what's flowing through us, then we're caught up again in subtle forms of clinging and therefore suffering. So being in the body is a great way to open out into our actual experience. As Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and close friend and attendant, said, mindfulness of the body is our best friend. It's always available, it cuts through the hindrances, and it promotes liberating insight. Right? Or, as the Buddha said, if you master the body, you master the mind. If you fail to master the body, you cannot master the mind. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how to do this, and then I'm going to wrap up with some big picture considerations. But first, are there any comments or questions so far? Sure. I'll just share with you as a transition then, and I'll do another opening for questions or comments too. The middle part of my retreat was taught by a monk and a nun, and it was quite exceptional. If you have an opportunity to do a retreat, unless you have a good reason to pick a different kind of retreat for some particular reason, which is perfectly fine, I really recommend retreats with monastics, because they're really deep. You know, they've been swimming in the deep waters. They've been drinking from the ultimate Kool-Aid. So you just get it. I mean, they're just so there. Well, so here's this trip. Here's this, the main teacher was a monk, and he was assisted by a nun, which was really quite beautiful, Ajahn Suchito and Ajahn Mehta. Ajahn Mehta was the nun. So Ajahn Suchito is English, and he's an abbot of a monastery, very dignified, big guy, bald head, wearing robes, really simple. So you look at him, and you just think, ascetic, master, you're super ascetic. But you know, he was one of the most in-his-body people I've met in my entire life. You know, he led us in Qigong every day. He was right out of these old Kung Fu movies, you know, this TV show kind of guy, just doing these different moves and things. The thing about it that was really striking was he was completely in his body, because he was just completely aware of his body, and he never let his attention desert his body. I thought it was so interesting and ironic that people who live a deeply ascetic life, in many ways, deeply renunciate life, can be so grounded in their body. You know, one thing I realized too about monks is that they own nothing. Monks and nuns, they're completely dependent, literally. I mean, they don't eat anything if you don't put it in their bowl. And they don't ask you to put anything in their bowl. They just stand there with their bowl and you put something in it or you don't. I remember Ajahn Amaro, another monk that I kind of, you know, personal acquaintance, said once he got 3 days before somebody finally put something in his bowl one time. And he was kind of wondering what was going to happen. But he was completely grounded in, they don't put it in my bowl, I don't eat. You know, literally, a piece of fruit on the ground, he won't pick it up and eat it. If they don't put it in the bowl, he's not going to eat it. So they're totally vulnerable, totally dependent. They have nothing. They don't own anything, basically. But they have all the time in the world. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. They just have all the time in the world. Like us, we think about something and, you know, like, oh, I ought to think about that. So we think about it for a few minutes, right? Or we go, you know, I ought to take that on as a practice today. So we take it on as a practice today. They'll think about it for a month because they have all the time in the world. Or they'll think about it all day, not amidst a bunch of other things. You know, they have all the time in the world. Okay, so ways to... yeah, please.
I just wanted to mention that I heard Ajahn Amaro allude to the fact that you said about how, 97% of our atoms or molecules change within the year.
Some large fraction like that, yeah.
And he said because all their food is donated, they're really in donated bodies after the
That's a wonderful thing. I hope you heard that. She pointed out that because there's a lot of throughput, you know, in the atoms in our body every year, some large fraction is... kind of unclear how large that fraction is, but it's a really large fraction, you know. And Ajahn Amaro was saying that since food is donated to them, their bodies are kind of donated by the end of a year or two. You know, they're living in a borrowed body, a donated body. Anyway, thank you, really.
Okay, some ways to embody practice. I better keep going, then we'll swing back. These came from the retreat and my own reflection. So you may recall that when I talked tonight about meditation, find a base in the body when you do formal meditation practice. Start with a base in the body. Take 10, 20, 30 seconds or a minute or two and feel settled. Feel here. You know, find a way of sitting that you're here. It's okay. You're allowed to be here. Think about the story of the Buddha when, on his own night of awakening, he was challenged by Mara. He reached down with his right hand and touched the earth. You know, and it was to basically have a sense of, I'm here, I'm all right, I get to be here. You know, I imagine my own version of that is I'm an animal organism. I'm in my habitat. I'm in my ecosystem. It's okay. I can be here. You know, I can be here in this chair. So that's a great way to start practice and a great way to come into almost any setting, especially if it's a challenging one, like at work or a family setting, or kind of rattled. Start by getting grounded in the body. Establish your base. You know, as the Prussian general and philosopher of war, von Clausewitz, said, first rule of warfare, secure a base of operations. So, you know, we'll take a page out of his book. Okay. Establishing centers, three centers, if you think about it, not to get too esoteric about it, but body, heart, and mind. So, grounded body, warm heart, clear mind. I don't know if you ever saw the movie, Kevin Costner is an aging pitcher. What anybody recall the title of that? You know, he has this moment. It'll come to me. But anyway, it's a fairly decent baseball movie, but the cool part in the storyline is that he's in the last game of his career and is starting to look like he might be throwing a no-hitter. And he has this internal thing he says to himself with the craziness of the crowd. He says, engage the mechanism. And it's as if he turns the volume sound almost off. He can't hear anything anymore. So, in other words, it's like there's a place for practices where we kind of stabilize, that have a routine to them. You know, grounded body, warm heart, clear mind. You know, or whatever your own versions of that are. Boom, we're here. Okay. Starting practice with a basic quality of contentment and ease. It's hard to be in the body when we don't have a basic sense of some kind of contentment, some kind of quality of ease. Find some body sensation. Maybe it's breathing, maybe it's something else that gives you that sense, that grounds you in that sense of contentment and ease. And that's a way to enter practice. You know, we often think, I'm going to get to contentment and ease. You know, I'm going to have that good moment by the end of the sitting if Rick ever rings the darn bell, right? But how about starting practice by opening up to and encouraging and locating? That's where wise effort comes in. That's an application of wise effort, a quality of basic contentment and ease. And that, of course, has to be felt in the body. Where else is contentment and ease? Moving in the body. It's very interesting. I've been doing this lately. I often go for a very stiff walk and run up in the hills above my house with a lot of elevation gain and then back down again. Or any kind of walk or exercise you do, pick some part of your body, like the hips or a good one, or pelvis, and just try to keep attention there. Stay in the body while doing something. You know, sure, thoughts may flitter around in the background, but why not pick something that's almost an object of attention, a concentration practice, when doing any kind of regular activity or setting a goal, like walking down the street. Okay, this next block, I'm going to stay in my body. And then when I get to the crosswalk, I'm going to regenerate that intention. Right? Or the lower level of the dishwasher. Till I finish loading that lower level, I'm going to stay in the body for the lower level of that dishwasher. Okay? All right. How about being the body itself? That's a real interesting one. Like, does your body know how to sit right now? Think of all the movements in your body. Think of all the little subtle things. Does your body know how to do that? Does it know how to write? Does it know how to move your legs? Does it know how to breathe? Does it know how to beat the heart? Kind of allowing that there's a lot of intelligence in the body from the bottom up, you know? And in other words, there are intelligence, the body knows things and the heart knows things that the head doesn't know. Listening to that intelligence, trusting it, and experimenting with and exploring the sense of just being given over to the body.
What's that like? Do you have a sense of what I mean by that? Where you just kind of, it's like you just give over to the body. You trust the body. You notice the body's doing it. Look at the way I'm moving my arms. I have no idea how to move my arms. My body knows how to move my arms. Yeah. Okay. You know, you could play around with this. We often think, I have a body, right? How about going the other way? This body has me, right? You know, we think maybe I made this body. Well, maybe the body made you. It's a very different way to think about it. It's being as a body. I think it's also powerful to engage practice as the body. For example, one thing I played around with was allowing instead of taking. And the insight about that for me was that somewhere in the middle of the retreat, I sat down my morning meditation, and the guy sitting next to me had a kind of a blanket over his legs because it was cold in the morning. And he kind of moved around, and his blanket was over on my space. You know, there's this, like, this little quadrant, you know, your chair, your space. And it was, and also I got to tell you, you know, because this particular retreat was the middle retreat, so I'd found the perfect chair, and I put my stuff on the perfect chair, and I was all set to go, and it really meant a lot to me where my chair was, because on the aisle, I was going to see the monks coming down the aisle, and I usually kind of hid over in the corner, so for me it was kind of a breakthrough to come out on the aisle. Anyway, but when I came in, darn, guess what? They had moved my chair. It was one in from the aisle, so can you believe it? I was already primed and ready to go. So anyway, a day or two later, I mostly got through that. That was okay. But a day or two later, the guy's blanket landed on my foot, so I kind of flicked it, and I kind of flicked it like that. And after I flicked it like that, I don't know if you can see my foot, I just kind of flicked it, you know, I kind of flicked it like that. I thought, shh, what have I done? So then I'm mind tripping about, you know, that I did that aggressive act. I'm like, what are you thinking? And then I noticed later at lunch that day, there was a, like, we were supposed to stand in a certain place while people were giving the monks food. And I just, there was a group of people, and I just wanted to get behind them, and they were kind of in the way, and I had my internal thought that, you know, these thoughts, they take about 3/4 of a second, but they're like, you know, you people are kind of clueless. Don't you understand? This is a passageway. You're crowding the passageway. I have kind of a trip about people crowding passageways. You know, like the people in, you know, a public auditorium, so you like stand in the doorways talking to their long-lost friend. You know, yeah. So I have a little trip going. So I was like, I got bell, you know, let me through. But it wasn't like, let me through, really sweet. It was like the wedge. And so the waters parted. I went through, and then I'm thinking, Rick, what are you doing? That's why I just started noticing. What is this about? It's like taking rather than allowing. So then after that, I just began to experiment with allowing. And it's very interesting to think about how we take, how often we take. We interrupt. We take space. We don't really need to take it. I'm not talking about being a doormat. I'm not talking about rightful assertiveness. But we just kind of grab, we take. We want the last cookie, right? We take one way or another. Think about American culture. Think about Western economic culture. As Ajahn Suchito said, very calmly and matter-of-factly and accurately, the human species is gutting the planet. You think about the petroleum products or the minerals or other things that have been produced over millions and millions of years. Every bit of petroleum that's consumed is irreplaceable. You can't make petroleum, you know? You need a lot of time and a lot of swamps, you know, and a lot of heat and a lot of pressure, you know, a long way underground to make petroleum. We take. It's very different to just allow, and that's in the body. And that's very interesting to just watch the bodily enactment of taking rather than allowing and see what that is for you. And then to talk about something kind of fundamental, and I hope I can do justice to this and try to be clear about it. Because everything's changing fast, right? And the equilibrium of the organism is continually disturbed. Any organism, whether it's a little bacteria or a paramecium, a little protozoan, or a lizard, a squirrel, a monkey, or a human being, is continually trying to stabilize all that change, you know? And that right there is dukkha. That right there is a kind of innate clinging and an attempt to stop the flow and stabilize things in a good place. All right? And there's also a kind of innate understanding in the organism that with everything changing, everything dispersing, there's a kind of deep down anxiety or panic at being dispersed. You can kind of feel it in the body, can't you? You know, there's this sort of core fear of death, of dispersal, of ending, of the eddy that we are, you know, or the eddy of our possessions, or the eddy of our view, or our opinion, or the event we want to have happen tonight when we get home, or the love we want to find, or the way we want our kids to be raised or turn out, whatever, that, or how we want our stocks to finally rise again, or the value of our house, or you know, we're worried about our health, that lump in our chest, or we've got an annual physical, we hope it goes well, whatever that is, we want it, right? We cling to a result. There's a natural kind of clinging to that result, all right? Sure, endings make way for beginnings, right? Sure, we can understand it intellectually, but viscerally, there's a kind of primal fear. You know, there's a kind of primal clinging that's in the body. By exploring that clinging and getting more and more at peace with this moment-to-moment sense of allowing it all to just blow away, you know, and being at peace with that reality, that it could all just blow away in the next moment, and then seeing what happens, and noticing that something usually good happens next. And it will until our last breath, right? Increasingly allowing that helps us get through this fear. In other words, there's a fear of dying, ending, dispersing, change, destabilization. And even more deeply, there's a fear of not clinging. If you think about it, we're afraid not to cling. We're afraid not to grasp. We're afraid not to resist. Like, oh my God, what will happen if I don't try to freeze this moment? So by tuning into that fear in the body, the fear that leads to clinging, the fear of even not clinging, the fear that blocks us from truly letting go. If we can do that and feel that in the body, that's a phenomenal doorway to the liberation from suffering. You know, as Ajahn Sumedho, he's a Western monastic, probably the senior Western monastic in the Vipassana tradition, said, you know, if there's really only one thing to teach, it's let go. You know, or as Ajahn Chah said, you know, the Godfather, as he said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. You know, and so trying to be aware of the fear in the body, the clenching in the body that resists opening out, that resists allowing, that it's afraid to stop clinging, you know, that's a very powerful practice right into, you know, living in a way that was an image that came often to me, as if you're standing over the elevator, right? It's as if, you know, imagine this, you know, imagine you're on the 29th floor, you hit the button, the elevator comes, you step in, and there's no floor. Right? That's how truly we're all living. There's no floor beneath us. And yet we still persist. You know, the eddy you are, and certain sub-eddies, eddies, within the mind, will persist until the last breath, to be sure. And yet the truth is, in life, we really are living, you know, with no floor beneath us. That's the truth. That's the nature of things. And accepting that, recognizing that truth, and then finding a way to be at peace with it, and then help the body, as Mary Oliver put it, the soft animal of the body, this poor body that just wants to live, right? And is panicked at that elevator shaft, because it can feel viscerally the undoing, the ending, the dying that began the day we were born. It feels that. Poor body. You know, to be nice to the body, to help this poor body calm and relax and be okay with that reality and continually notice that there's a renewal that follows every ending. There's a beginning that comes after every ending. And to realize that there's a greater peace, a greater goodness for the body in living in harmony with that reality, you know, that's a profound practice and a great gift we can give this sweet body that's worked so hard for each one of us for so many years. So any comments or questions before I move to a wrap? Yeah.
Rick, repeatedly I find myself rather overwhelmed by your presentations. This is an example of that tonight. It's impossible for me to come forward with a question or a comment. And I often think about writing you a note to express this. I can't do that because in a way that even trivializes what happened. So I think I'm speaking for many.
Thank you. Well, I hope we're speaking for Ajahn Mun, you know, and this lineage that we're all part of. And I appreciate that. And, you know, did everybody get a chance to see this, by the way? Why don't we pass it all the way to the back and pass it around? Well, let me, if I could, say a few more words, and then we can wrap it up, and I'll pick it up again next week, okay? So here we are. At the elevator shaft, you know? Here we are. So here's a quote from Kalu Rinpoche. He's another one of my favorites at the Spirit Rock Gratitude Hut, which is in the public area. You can just go there and look in it. It's this little hut. It's really worth doing. He just looks so happy in his picture. He says, "You live in illusion and the appearance of things." I'll say his whole thing, then I'll come, because it's really short and sweet, then I'll come back. He says, "You live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality, but you do not know this. When you understand this, you will see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all." Thanks. Thanks, Rinpoche. So I think what he's getting at is that the conventional reality is that we're all walking around in a big brick, you know, with legs, the body brick, right? The brick body. It's solid, it's enduring, it's going to last, and then we croak, right? But it's kind of like that. But as she said earlier, the body is really a process. It's more like a standing wave, you know, where a river goes over a boulder, this wave is thrown up, all right? And in reality, our existence is intertwined with everything. Right? So in a sense, we really are nothing. I mean, any given cloud is nothing. The cloud is intertwined with the sky. You know, any given person, in a fundamental sense, is nothing. It's interdependent. There's no absolute boundary between Harold and anyone else, between myself and anyone else. That's the way it really is. But then coming to peace with that and getting that in a fundamental way, well, if I'm nothing, that means that I'm everything, really. There is this interdependent connectedness with everything most fundamentally. And I think that's what he was getting at. If you think about it, and here, if you'll forgive me, I think I might read a little bit because I wrote some of this and tried to be a little clear about it. This came much from my journal, actually. "Each compounded thing, including me and you, is nothing. It's a pattern, an eddy, not truly individual, not truly separate. It's dispersing already on one scale or another. A gust of air, a cloud, a moth, a bird, a man, a woman, an oak, a mountain, this galaxy, Earth, the cosmos, it's all dispersing all the time, one way or another. Endlessly ending." Now, there are these four elements in Buddhism: earth, water, fire, and air. And what that really stands for is solidity, okay, cohesion, movement and heat, or if you think about it, matter and energy. So coming down on a walk, I was crossing a little brook, and I just was reflecting on these four elements, which is one of the meditations in Buddhism, and I was seeing water and sunlight reflected under the trees, elements of water and fire, earth and air. And then I realized that the same elements were in me, just like you were saying, in effect, the same elements. There's a continuity, in other words. The same elements are continuous. The elements of cohesion, solidity, movement, and heat or cold. They're present in everything, right? We're coexistent with those elements, coextensive with them. And I realized I'm compounded of them, right? They're in me as well. And then I realized as well that consciousness is conditioned by those elements. In other words, awareness and the contents of awareness arise through those elements. Right? It's of them too. It's bound up with them in a non-problematic way. It's non-problematically entwined. So consciousness, grounded in this body and its elements, personal awareness that feels so intimate, right? The body isn't that intimate, but awareness, me, you know, what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what it's like to live, the experience of being, okay? Isn't that really intimate? That's the closest it gets to home. That's all going to swirl away one day, you know, caught up in all these elements. And that's okay, because consciousness is continuous with those elements, and those elements are continuous with the world. It really is all just one thing. You know, it's all carried by the one stream. There's only one allness. There's only one totality. And we are coextensive, coexistent, you know, co-abiding as that one totality, here and now. And the most direct way to recognize that is in the body. So, to close here, I want to say to you some words in Pali, the original language of the teachings of the Buddha, that have been uttered for 2,500 years, and then I'll translate them, and then we'll close. You may have heard these words. Anicca vata sankara, upada vaya domino, upakitua nirojihanti, tesang upasamo sukho. All conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. So thank you for your sweet attention tonight. May you be well. Many bows. So see you next week and keep on going.